on these jungle cruises and all of these adventures, all of which would be completely a lie and not be a service to the wonderful work he has actually done. So I will instead say graciously, Bill, if you would please introduce yourself as you come up, and then he is going to move into our message, Ceasefire, Reflections on Crises in Gaza.
Well, it's good to be here. Some of you were here when I was here some time ago. I can't remember the last time we were up here. I always loved this sanctuary, and I like this community. I remember Emily Kennedy was one of my best critics, and we had wonderful times. I remember Glenda wrote a song, actually, from something that Emily asked me one time on Sunday morning, when we went downstairs for our communion, you know, coffee, and she said, Bill, I'd like to hear a sermon on grace. And I said, well, okay. And she said, well, when are you going to preach a sermon on grace? I said, well, Glenda popped up and said, my grandpa had a horse named Grace. And so she said, when are you going to do that? And I said, well, I'll do it next time. She said, what's the title? I said, I guess it'll be A Horse Named Grace. And some of you probably remember us singing that song when we did that sermon. So, you know, we have a lot of good memories about this community, and it's been good. You know, just a quick bio. I grew up, as some of you might know, in a fundamentalist, well, it didn't call it fundamentalist back there. I called it Holiness Church, a Nazarene church down in southern Indiana. My mother and dad had three sets of twins and three singles, of which my twin and I were the last two to come along. And I started preaching when I was about 15 years old, and tent revivals and church revivals, and it's where I met Glenda, preaching a revival at her church in 1967. And that was the beginning of our long and perilous journey. It's been good. And then my daughter started attending. My wife and I did simple living for a while. We kind of dropped out. We didn't want to pay taxes for war anymore, and we wanted to be full-time parents. I couldn't realize that I couldn't be a full-time minister and be a full-time parent at the same time. So we ended up going back to the Neverland of simple living, which included 5 years in a teepee with our teenage children in Brown County, Indiana, and a lot of music and singing and traveling around doing peace actions. And, you know, I was lucky in my life to meet people who made me think about what things are and what things are not, and got me on the road to being a peacenik. And then my daughter, luckily, began to attend the Unitarian Church in Bloomington, and I was a minister there, ended up being a minister there for 13 years, co-minister, and retired in 2014. So that's a general description of where I've been. I am also a minister on federal death row, and have been visiting federal death row for 16 years and accompanied a man to his execution during the Trump bar murder sprees of 2021-22. So it's been an interesting journey, and Danville, this little community, was part of it for quite a while. We used to come up here once a month, I think, for quite a while, and it was fun. Well, the discussion today, I want to do a couple of things. Memorial Day is not my favorite day of the year, to be honest with you. I've never liked to preach on Memorial Day because people expect patriotism on Memorial Day, and I'm not a patriot. And I think that the United States, we in this country have made a fetish of war. We decorate all of our courthouse lawns with weapons of war, soldiers. I was really surprised when in 2009, when Glenda and I traveled down to Mexico. I had a sabbatical and we're going down there to begin writing. And we traveled through Mexico, and all the way, we traveled several thousand miles driving an old Buick all over Mexico. I never saw a monument to war, never. You saw a monument to workers, to labor. You saw the courthouses would have pictures of melons and fruit and things like this of the people who built their country, laborers. And I was amazed by that, that you just didn't see monuments to war. And I think one of the problems we have in the United States is we have this idea that war has made us great, when war has really diminished us every time. I grew up in a military family. My family goes back all the way to my relatives. I go all the way back to the Revolutionary War. And just to give you what changed, some of the things that changed my thinking about war, when I was a teenager, we lived right by the Crane Naval Weapons Base, the largest inland naval base in the world. And my dad and family had moved there before I was born, and he helped build that base. And our land was bordering that base. So I used to grow up watching the jets dogfight over the 67,000 acres of woods down there. And I had one brother off the coast of Vietnam and two other brothers in the military, and I expected to do the same. But thank goodness my mother decided that she had given three boys to the military, and she decided her last two twin boys were not going to go. And so she convinced us we had to be preachers. And I was supposed to be the next Billy Graham. And I was well on my way to that. And I tell veterans these days, which I respect veterans, I think they made, most of them made choices out of for good reasons, but the fact is that most of them in my day were drafted and didn't have any choice, and most of them were lied to. In fact, basically all of us were lied to about every war we've been in. So I became a pacifist. And really, I take the teachings of Jesus very seriously. I think Jesus was I believe he was a real person. I believe he taught pacifism and love. And I can't imagine him carrying an AK-47 around or an M-16 or anything like that. That's kind of where I'm at as a human being. I'm in staunch opposition to any war. I spent about 3 weeks in Israel and the West Bank during the Second Intifada. A young people in Bloomington wanted to go on a peace fact-finding mission, and they called me and asked me if they paid my way, would I go with them? Well, I'll go anywhere if somebody pays the way. That's just the way it's always been. It's the way we travel. And so I said yes. And we flew in as individuals because as a peace group, we would have never been allowed into Israel. But we I landed on the night that the ceasefire stopped and the Second Intifada ignited. It stopped because the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, assassinated a man in Jenin who they had identified as the father of a suicide bomber. And the next morning, as I was sleeping in the old city of Jerusalem waiting for the other members of the group to arrive, I was awakened by a bomb that blew a bus up. And then we spent about 19 days in and out of the West Bank. So I know what it's like over there. And I want to talk a little bit about the Gaza situation this morning because it's been something on my mind daily. I want to talk a little bit about Mr. Netanyahu. He's the longest serving prime minister in Israel's history. He's serving 6-year terms, totaling more than 16 years. And for years, he took pride in his security credentials, saying he wanted to be remembered as a protector of Israel. Several months after a war in Gaza ended in 2009, Netanyahu came back to power and promised to topple Hamas. The fact is, he has not toppled Hamas. He's actually strengthened Hamas. He allowed, encouraged money to be spent sent to Hamas in order to weaken the Palestinian Authority, the more moderate Palestinian leadership of Mahmoud Abbas. And all the millions and millions of dollars that went into Hamas, where they built all their tunnels and got all their weapons and so forth, was really done with Netanyahu's awareness and knowledge through other countries. The other interesting thing about the October 7th, and let me be very clear, I consider Hamas a terrorist organization. October 7th was a terrorist attack, and a lot of innocent people died. But it didn't come out of a vacuum. Fact is that the Israeli Defense Forces and the intelligence had clear printed pictures of the plan of Hamas, where they had planned to come in, and so forth. And that's been a woman, intelligence officer, discovered this and reported it, and they just set it aside, hid it. They knew they were coming. And just before October 7th, Netanyahu ordered the troops that protected that border crossing where Hamas had planned to attack, he ordered them to the West Bank to protect settlers. And just to tell you what settlers are in the West Bank, settlers are about 90% Eastern European Jews who were invited to come to Israel, shown beautiful homes, and came out of Eastern Europe poverty to these beautiful settlements in the West Bank. And I traveled with several, it's a desert area out there, desert, very little water. And in the middle of that desert are these huge settlements that have, one of them we traveled into, have Olympic-sized swimming pool in the middle of the settlement, beautiful houses. Well, sure, anybody would love to come live there. And so that's what Netanyahu has been doing again and again through several U.S. presidents, with the support of several U.S. presidents, has increased those settlements exponentially during his 16 years. It's illegal. It's been condemned by the United Nations. It is taking territory. It's stealing land. And when I landed in Tel Aviv in 2004, I got a cab, one of these vans, and that was packed with people going to Jerusalem. And a young man there with a master's degree from the United States, born and raised in Israel, in Jerusalem, was telling all the tourists coming about the country we were driving into. And I was sitting listening to him, and he repeated the oft-quoted line, when in 1947, this was a land without people, for people without a land. When 1947, the Nakba, which most Americans do not know what it means the day that Israel invaded and drove out the Palestinians. But he was saying it was a land without people, and we were driving by past buildings that were hundreds of years old. And I stopped him. I said, you're trying to tell me that this was an empty land? There were thousands, tens of thousands of Israelis or Palestinians who were driven off their land. And that lie is still told today. So when the Gaza invasion started, as you well know, students across this country and universities began occupying spaces in protest of that thing. And IU was no exception. We had a large gathering of students who gathered in Dunmetal. If you've ever been to IU on 7th Street, there's a large metal there that during the Vietnam War, the student body and the large protests against the Vietnam War, the student body and the university finally declared Dunmetal to be a free speech area. And so that's been recognized all these years as a free speech. And I have actually been personally involved in occupying that area three or four different times. And never were the police called. During the first Iraq War of George Bush, we spent 45 days in Dunmetal. We had tents all around the place. It was cold. It was wintertime. The dean of students would come down and have coffee with us. And that's the way it was dealt with in those days of free speech. Now we have an IU administration that doesn't really believe in that. And so when the students gathered and protested and begin to set up their tents. The state police were called in. There were snipers on the top of the student union building, and there was no violence whatsoever until the police came. And it was a very rough evening. I missed it. I actually told the students later, and I visited them. They're still there. I went to see them night before last, and they're still, it's the most beautiful encampment we've ever seen on Dunmetal. These people are organized. It's unbelievable. We didn't have cell phones when we did this. You had to go grab people. But it's the most organized, beautifully run occupation I've ever seen. They're beautiful young people down there, and they're still there. And I'll be checking in on them. I spent a couple of nights, but my sleeping on the ground is in my years past. I don't think I can survive that anymore. But what we have to look at in this occupation of Gaza, this destruction of Gaza, the fact is that there have been more than 35,000 Palestinians killed so far, over 75,000 injured. And as of March 7th, there were 247 Israeli soldiers killed, with 1,400 injured since the start of this occupation. And if you go back over the history of this occupation and against the West Bank, the number of Palestinian deaths to Israeli deaths is better than 10 to 1. And always, it's Palestinians who have paid the greatest price for violence. UN representative has said this is a war on children. And we had a Michigan Republican congressman here recently said they should end it quick, just like we did with Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That is the kind of thinking that is running our country. That is the kind of thinking that I think we have to stand against. So let me ask the question, head of the state police, when all the uproar over this over the violence that was perpetrated against the students, several of them arrested, when he responded to the leader of the state police said, well, we responded because of hate speech being used. Well, I don't know if he's read the Constitution or not, but even hate speech is protected by the speech is protected. But the fact is there was no hate speech there. There was speech against war. There was speech in which Israel was called a terrorist state. And my question was, have we not been a terrorist state in Vietnam? Were we not a terrorist state? Are we not still a terrorist state in some places? Jimmy Carter figured out that we have only had 16 years of peace in our 200 and over 50 years of existence now. 16 years of years in which we were not at military action, at war, or occupation in some other country in the world. 16 out of 250 years. It's more than that now, I think. But we have been a terrorist state for a long time. Jimmy Carter, who I think is one of the most profound Christians that I have ever seen or heard of and listened to, has called Israel an apartheid state. And the fact is that South Africa, just as when we occupied Dunmetal with a shanty town during the apartheid protest, South Africa continually said, we're just doing to our blacks what you did to your Indians. We're doing exactly what you did. And Israel, Netanyahu, has said, is basically doing the same thing. They're doing the same thing that we did to our native people here. When I was in Israel, we met with people, both Israelis and Palestinians, Israeli soldiers who were resisting the occupation, a group of Israeli soldiers who refused to serve in the West Bank. And we met with an official who was actually a translator for the peace accords during the Carter administration. And he was talking to us, and he said that the Palestinians don't know a good deal when they see it. We offered them 90% of the land that they wanted, 90%, and they turned it down. And I told him, I said, you know, I visit prisons. I'm a prison minister, and I go to prisons in the United States. And I said, every prison I go to, the prisoners control 90% of the space. but the guards have the keys to the gates. As you travel across West Bank, you cannot go 15 miles without hitting a checkpoint. And it may, if you want to see your grandparents who may live 15, 16 miles away, it may take you 2 days to get there because you'll be stopped at checkpoints, especially if you're Palestinian. Being Americans, we were stopped several times, but we could usually get through. The fact is, we have been supporting an apartheid country, an apartheid state in Israel for a long time. And the safest thing, and do you remember before this occupation happened, there were tens of thousands of Israelis protesting against Netanyahu. He has felony charges against him. Without this war, he would very likely be in prison. He would have been out of office, which kind of explains why the setup was so perfect to get a war. This is Netanyahu's war, and it's also America's war because every day the weapons used are made right here in America, right here in America. Genocide is genocide regardless of the perpetrators. There's no way to get around it. I've got a piece here I want to read to you, if I can find it. Well, I've lost it. Some of it, anyway. Now, here it is. I want to finish with a poem by Bob Dylan. Dylan's birthday was this week. He's 83 years old. I have to tell you, I didn't know Bob Dylan. I didn't know the hippie music. People, we're aftermarket hippies. My twin brother and I, we call ourselves, we're hippies. We weren't around when the hippies were around. We were preaching holiness theology. We thought all these people were just crazy people. And the fact is that the hippies were right. Love is more powerful than hate. Love is good. And you all, many of you probably remember the hippies much better than I do. But my first exposure to Bob Dylan was not his music, because we couldn't listen to his music. We listened to gospel music all the time. My first exposure was in class. We had a young teacher from Oakland City, his first year teaching, came to Odin, Indiana. He was obviously gay. I mean, as gay as you could get, but nobody talked about it. He was the best teacher I ever had. And he only lasted 1 year in Odin, Indiana because he was gay. But in my junior year, he came into class one day with a poem. And he said, I want you to tell me what's this poem say to you? And he handed us out this poem called Blowing in the Wind. I didn't know it was a song. I'd never heard it. And we struggled through this poem, and finally he told us about, you know, the atomic test and all these things and the nuclear problems. And he's the one who really made me think for the first time in my life that maybe I was wrong about some things. Maybe my religion was wrong about some things. He's the one that encouraged me to write and to think for myself. So here's a poem from Bob Dylan. Far between my finished sundown and midnight's broken toll, we ducked inside the doorways. Thunder went crashing as majestic bells of boats struck shadows in the sounds, seeming to be the chimes of freedom flashing. Flashing for the warriors whose strength is not to fight, flashing for the refugees or the unarmed road of flight. And for each and every underdog soldier in the night, and we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing. Through the city's melting furnace, unexpectedly we watched, with faces hidden as the walls were tightening, as the echo of the wedding bells before the blowing rain dissolved into the bells of the lightning, tolling for the rebel, tolling for the rake, tolling for the luckless, the abandoned, and the forsaken, tolling for the outcast burning constantly at stake, and we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing. Through the mad mystic hammering of the wild ripping hail, the sky cracked its poem in naked wonder, that the clinging of the church bells blew far into the breezes, leaving only bells of lightning and its thunder. striking for the gentle, striking for the kind, striking for the guardians and protectors of the mind. And the poet and the painter pull out of his rightful time, and we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing. Through the wild cathedral evening, the rain unraveled tales for the disrobed faceless forms of no position, tolling for the tongues with no place to bring their thoughts, all down in taken for granted situations, tolling for the blind and deaf, tolling for the mute, for the mistreated mateless mother, the mistitled prostitute, for the misdemeanor outlaw chased and cheated by pursuit, and we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing. Even though a cloud's white curtain in a far-off corner flared and the hypnotic splattered mist was slowly lifting, electric lights still struck like arrows, fired but for the ones condemned to drift or else be kept from drifting. Tolling for the searching on their speechless seeking trail, for the lonesome-hearted lovers with too personal a tale, and for each unharmful, gentle soul misplaced inside a jail, and we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing. Starry-eyed and laughing as I recall when we were caught, trapped by no track of ours, for they hanged suspended, and we listened one last time, and we watched with one last look, spellbound and swallowed till the tolling ended, tolling for the aching ones whose wounds cannot be nursed, for the countless, confused, accused, misused, strung out ones and worse, and for every hung up person in the whole wide universe, and we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing. Dylan was a voice for a generation. He remains a voice for generations today, because the fact is, continually, we hear or we listen for chimes of freedom flashing, and yet we continue the war against basically the people. Yet we put our faith, you know, in God we trust. It says, I refuse to have that on my license plate because it's a bold-faced lie. We don't trust in God. We trust in guns, and that's what we ought to have our license plates. We trust in guns. We trust in bombs. The one thing that is never cut is the military budget. And it cost us more than just money. It cost us our children, our daughters, our sons, our grandchildren. And it cost us their souls, because war destroys that. I wish Netanyahu would read from his own testament, the Jewish testament, the words of Hosea, when he said, "Because you've trusted in the size of your chariots and the multitude of your warriors, therefore the tumult of war shall be upon your people, and all of your fortresses will be destroyed." Again and again, the prophets of the Old and the prophets of the New Testament warned against the worship of state and the worship of war. And I think on this Memorial Day, I think on every Memorial Day, we should not make a fetish of war. We don't honor veterans in this country when you consider the number of homeless veterans all over this land. You see them in Bloomington all the time, standing at the lights. And you know, I keep a lot of $1 bills above our sun dollar, our sun visor. Glenda puts them there because, you know, people say, "Well, don't give them money. They'll just go buy booze or something." I don't care what they do with their money. They're living in hell. And I've got a little bit to give. I'm going to give it to them. And I'm going to look them in the eye. And I'm going to call them brother or sister. And I'm going to let them know that somebody cares. And if we're too afraid of them, if we're too arrogant in front of them, then why do we honor them on Memorial Day? Why? It becomes a fetish. War is a fetish that America can't get over. I do hope, I didn't really want to be a despairing preacher this morning, but I've been spending some time with the students in the middle, and I spend time with people in prison. And what I want people to do is try to re-envision what it means to be an American. Try to re-envision what it might mean if we begin to teach our children to say no to violence. And we begin to support them when they do so. What it might be, what America might be, if we rejected the kinds of politician that quote Adolf Hitler in their speeches, and we reject the kind of Christianity, Christian nationalism, which is nothing more than fascism. That's a code word for fascism. No, I do not want a Christian nation. And no, I do not believe in a Jewish nation. I don't believe in any religious nation. Every time in history you put a name of a religion before your nation, you end up with genocide, crusades, war. That's simply the nature of religious states. So I think Unitarian Universalism has a specific message that the church is not the servant of the state. The church is a prophet to the state. That's the way it has always been. That's the way the Christian church has been, the element that started this whole Christian religion. The early Christian community, the reason they were crucified and burned at the stake and murdered and all things by the Roman Empire is that they refused to go to war. They refused to pay for war, and they did that for three centuries almost before the emperor realized he had to become a Christian and talk everybody into following the sword. Before that, the symbol of the church was a fish because they fed the poor. When Constantine became a Christian, he made them worship the cross. Unitarian Universalism does not do that. And we have, a specific message for people. And I think it's a message that people are ready to hear. And I hope you share it. And I hope that you stand for peace. And I hope you also do not lose hope. Because I personally think the young people, if you want to get your hope built back up, go visit Don Meadow right now. Go meet the kids down there, the young people down there who are occupying that space. I told them I was disappointed not to be there when the arrests were made. I haven't been arrested in years, and I kind of miss it. And I told them, I wish I could have gone to jail with you. But every time I stop, they appreciate me stopping down there, that this old guy comes down sometimes at night and says, you people, by your presence, are making a difference. And they are. So I invite you to visit. If you come to Bloomington, go to the Meadow. Go to the Meadow and see the students. They're still there. They plan to be there for a while. And we'll be having an interfaith service there in this next month. And they're an amazing young people. And that's where my hope comes from, is the young people, they're waking us up. And if you're not woke, get woke. Get woke. Love it. Embrace it. Wokeness works. Thank you for being here today. It's an honor to be with you.
Any questions?
Any questions, responses, thoughts?
Yeah.
Julian.
Is it Julian?
Yeah. All right, so I did have a quick question. Obviously, the protests at the campuses serve the purpose of raising the awareness. Mm-hmm. Could you give me a few other insights on what other purpose they serve, like specifically protesting on a campus?
Well, I think that the students, number one, they protest on the campus because there is a free speech zone there, mm-hmm. and it's supposed to be a safe place to do that. But the other thing is that I think they understand that this is their planet. This is your planet. It's not mine anymore. I've already wasted, I've been here almost 75 years, and that's about enough, I suppose. But what I have to say is I don't earn this planet. My generation is doing a great job of destroying it, and we've forgotten what the 60s tried to teach us. So my sense is that students understand that this is their planet, and they're trying to save it. And the university is a place where we should learn what teaching, what living is about and what the earth is about. So I think it's a great place for them to be. And it's honoring a tradition that goes back to the 1960s on that medal. So they really, and you know, they're not just there protesting against that war, they're also asking Indiana University to divest from military spending, because Indiana University has just recently signed a huge contract of multi-millions of dollars with the Crane Naval Weapons Base and technology for war. And I think the university is the last place where we ought to learn to kill. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the question.
Julian, when I think of that question too, I am reminded of myself and the first time that I entered a queer space at DePaul, coming from a family where it wasn't safe to talk about that. And so just the opportunity of, yes, those who are bought in and can occupy those spaces, but the fact that so many others who are at the university who may have come from a background where they couldn't hear that message are welcomed into that space to hear that message. There are a lot of students that might just be walking by and hear that, and that might be the first time that they hear somebody expressing free speech in that way. And so it's both, I think, for the people that are there, but also for a lot of the students who are walking by and come from households that they've never heard somebody free to express those kind of messages.
I haven't been to the university, and I can't keep up with my life as it is, so I probably won't make it down there, or I'd love to. But from what I've read, it sounds like there are anti-Semitic comments made on campus, but they're mostly not at Dunn Meadow. And the same is true at other, and I wonder if you wanted to speak to that at all.
Yeah. First, I want to say, in terms of anti-Semitic speech, I've not heard that. There's anti-Netanyahu, there is anti-Israel speeches. But being against a state is not being against Semitic people. And people need to recognize that Palestinians are Semitic people. They're all related. You know, if you read the history of the Palestinian people and the Israeli people, they come from the same space, same line. The right-wing news feed of Fox News and others, and the ones that are even farther right than Fox, which is hard to believe there is such a thing, but they spread this anti-Semitic speech, scaring people. There was no anti-Semitic speech on IU, but the right wing picked that up and spread it all over the place. And it just doesn't, you know, It was a scare tactic. And we have friends, Glenda and I have a very close friend who is very afraid. But there's been no violence whatsoever on the Indiana campus, except when the police came, that brought some violence. But the violence against protesters, I'd say, including professors and others. Mm-hmm. So the whole anti-Semitic scare is basically it's a scare tactic, and I have not seen real evidence of anti-Semitism. I've seen anti-war and anti-occupation, and I think the fallback every time is it's anti-Semitic. It's not true, I don't think.
I want to read a poem if I can find it. So
okay.
Is that the Mary Oliver one?
Oh.
Okay. Anyone else?
So I don't watch much of the news. Seeing visual images of what's going on in Gaza and other places that have to do with violence and war, it just really puts me in a low place. And so one morning, Bill was at his computer, and I was in the kitchen making cookies. And he all of a sudden I heard him crying. And so, you know, I said, so what's up, Bill? And so I walked over to him, and he said, it's these poems I'm reading by this Palestinian poet. Mm-hmm. And so I read it, you know, and it was about a man walking through the destroyed city and what he was seeing and just the destruction and the sadness and the violence of the place. And then he said, and this other poem, and it was about a father holding his child and hiding and basically lying to the child, the little one, saying, no, something about the noises outside. No, they're not coming closer. No, we'll be safe here. And trying to be a safe place for this child, all the while knowing that it was coming closer and knowing what was going on. And, you know, I read those, and it takes me there with them, especially how the poet writes it, how the poet has a way of saying these things. So I went back to making my cookies. And I don't know if you all, when you make peanut butter cookies, which is what I was making, but when I make peanut butter cookies, I crisscross them. And so with those poems on my mind, I continued making the cookies for my mom, who I was going to see the next day, making cookies for Bill because he loves cookies so much, and making cookies for the kids that this poet was talking about. That was in my mind. And so as I was crisscrossing the cookies, I was saying, peace, please, peace, please, peace, please. And it took me to a place. There's a line in a Mary Oliver poem that says, my heart dresses in black. My heart dresses in black and dances, I think. Something like that. My heart dresses in black and dances. And that's kind of where I have to be with it. It's like I know it's there. I'm aware. All the statistics and the scenes and the voices, the poets. And I'm aware, and I want to be aware, and I also have to find the joy. I have to find, okay, peace, please, I'll make the cookies. Here's your cookies, Mom. Here's your cookies, Bill. You know, it's like doing the work of kindness and family and community with all the other that's in the world. And that's what my poem was about, and it wasn't nearly as long as what I am talking. So I apologize for that. But anyway, I just want to share that.
That poet, his name is Joseph Fasano. And I one of the greatest poets I've read, living poets, for a long time. Thank you.